Howdy, everybody. Welcome to West Virginia and Commonplace. I am J.R. Sparrow, your host, and I know it's been a long time. I've been in Orlando, all over these places for podcast conference, but we're back with a interview. We have Ray Hartgen with us here, and the nostalgic question that we ask Ray all the time is, who is Ray Hartgen? But before we do that, I want you to take the floor real quick and let the people know something that's interesting about you that, I mean, tell us who you are. But let us know something interesting that no one knows about you.
No one knows about me. Oh, wow,
yes.
Man. My name is Ray Hartgen, and I am a writer and a musician. And one thing that most people don't know about me, I was just thinking about this today. I saw the movie City Slickers with a girlfriend. Remember that movie, Billy Crystal, Jack Palance?
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, he's on this cattle drive with them, and he's, you know, and he, Billy Crystal's looking at Jack Palance, this cowboy, and he's like, man, Curly, you seem to have it. Curly's the character's name. He's like, Curly, you seem to have it. You have it all together. You seem to like know, you know, what's important to you. You know, what's your secret? And he holds up his one finger. And Billy Crystal is like, what? Your stinky glove and finger? He goes, no, it's your one thing. You know, and once you figure out your one thing is, then you've got a like a North Star to go for it. So movie's over. My girlfriend and I walk out of the movie, get in the car, and she looks at me and she goes, oh, you know, what's your one thing? I think I know what she wanted to hear now. But the first thing that came to my mind when she said it was the Indy 500. So needless to say, I'm happily married, been happily married for almost 30 years, but not to that person. I was too young, too stupid to understand exactly what she was asking
for. Oh, man. That's an interesting thing. So let's go into this. So your career has spanned different fields, from investment banking to pharmaceuticals, and now as a writer and a musician. How has storytelling been a constant throughout the pivots in your professional journey?
Yeah, it's always been about telling the story. You know, in investment banking, it was, you know, what's the story for the business? How are we going to raise money for this business? And it's got to be this compelling narrative, right? You know, and I spent a lot of time, after that, I wanted to retool myself, went to school, got an MBA, and started with organizational development. And a lot of that was just, you know, communication, telling the story of the company, telling the story of the team, having the team tell their story to the company, and so on. Got involved in corporate communications, marketing, all that is just storytelling. And it blends in well with my interests. You know, as a writer, you know, I tried to convey stories in words. As a musician, I tried to convey stories and emotions either through, you know, music or through the words that accompany the music, ideally with both. Telling the story and hopefully connecting with the audience at an emotional level. Because then they remember you, right? And that's the key to a good storytelling. You know that. You're a great storyteller.
Yes.
Being able to connect to them on a human-to-human level and being able to evoke some sort of emotional response to them. And, you know, I think that's, you know, at the end of the day, no matter what you do professionally, you know, if you can make those connections and if you connect with, on the emotional side of a person, then you're going someplace. Even if you're writing code, if you're a coder and you're not even working with a lot of people, people are going to be using your code. They're going to be interfacing with your code. And if you can reach them and touch them, make an impact on them, then you got them. Then you've got a customer and you've got, you know, customer satisfaction.
Okay. I like that. Now we're going to talk about your professional pivots real quick. What led you to navigate such a varied professional landscape, and how have these experiences shaped your perspective on work and life? And the reason I ask you that is because, like, you have the whole spectrum in working, basically.
Yeah. I think a testimony to me not being able to keep a job, JR. That must be right. My new book is a book called Me, Myself, and My Multiple Myeloma. And I wanted to come on and speak to your audience about this. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in March of 2019. And for those in your audience who aren't aware of the disease, it's a blood cancer. It's an incurable blood cancer, but treatable blood cancer. And you know what? When I was diagnosed with it, I think when anyone is diagnosed with any type of chronic serious illness, there's a lot of thoughts that go into it. You know, a lot of the, you know, like this mental and emotional and spiritual types of things that kind of hit you, and it gets to be overbearing. But, you know, cancer has given to me, provided for me more than it's taken away. And I talk about this a lot with inpatient support groups and the like. And, you know, I wanted to share with you and with your audience, things that kind of helped me make a pivot to do stuff that was most important for me, the things that matter most to me, the things that give me the greatest sense of joy, the things that give me the, you know, a peace of mind, sense of accomplishment, and so forth. And it really started soon after my diagnosis with a timeline exercise. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the timeline exercise, super simple. You grab a sheet of paper, you draw a horizontal line across it. On the far left-hand side, you make a tick mark. On the far right-hand side, you make a tick mark. Your left-hand tick mark, that is your birth. Your right-hand tick mark, that is your death. And then the hard part comes in. You look at that timeline, you think, where are you now? You know, whenever I did that timeline exercise prior to my diagnosis, you know, I was, you know, someplace in the middle or whatever. Heck, I was going to live forever. All of a sudden, with a cancer diagnosis, I'm like, man, I have an uncertain future. We all have an uncertain future, but it actually hit me for the first time that my future is much more uncertain than it was just yesterday. And I'm probably a lot farther to the right of my timeline than I am toward the center or what have you. So, you know, doing that timeline exercise kind of, led me to adopting a motto. And as a musician, I'm always looking for a motto, JR, to put on the back of a band t-shirt, right? You know, so what's the way that we can maximize our revenue streams when we're doing a gig, right? So let's have a t-shirt with kind of a cool motto on the back. Motto here, if not now, when? You know, it's like tomorrow's not promised. You know, you've got this gift of today. If not now, when? You know, and it led me to articulate in my mind how I took, and I think it's part of the human condition, how I took things for granted. I took time for granted. I took people for granted, and I took relationships for granted amongst the many things that I took for granted. And being able to articulate that in my mind, it's like, you know, hey, let's stop taking things for granted, like with people and relationships, like, you know, JR, my friend JR, I'm thinking about him. Oh, I'll call him tomorrow. I'll call him next week. That's what I'll do. I'll put a note down and I'll get back to him next month or whatever. It's like, man, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to take that relationship for granted. I love you. I care for you. I want to support you the best I can. I want to be a good friend. I'm going to connect with him right now. You know, and I was very guilty of taking time for granted. You know, someday I am going to ... And, you know, it was all tomorrows for granted, next week, next month, next year, sometimes decades, right? And so that if not now, when pivoted me. And, you know, an example I like to give is my first book. It's a book called Immaculate, How the Steelers.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I wanted to talk about that one too.
And, you know, I am not a Pittsburgh native. I'm not a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. I was born in Houston, Texas. I was born in 1964. So when I was growing up, I was a good Texan and I was a fan of the Dallas Cowboys because I was a good Texan. And the Dallas Cowboys, of course, lost two Super Bowls to the Steelers. My second favorite team was the Houston Oilers because I was born in Houston and I was a good Texan. So they were my second favorite team, Houston Oilers. They lost two playoff games to the Pittsburgh Steelers, never could win the AFC Central Division. And then my third favorite team was my mama's favorite team. My mama, like everybody else's mama, liked Kenny Stabler of the Oakland Raiders. So the Oakland Raiders, my third favorite team. And they, of course, famously lost three playoff games to the Steelers. So Steelers, as a kid, gum on my shoes, man. And JR, I got to tell you, man, the 12-year-old Ray would be thinking, man, that 50-some-year-old Ray who wrote a book on Pittsburgh Steelers, I don't think I like that guy. my co-author of that book is a man named Tom Olenek. Tom's the Yinzer. He's the guy from Pittsburgh. He loves his town and, but he's not a writer. He is a biotech executive, a very accomplished biotech executive. And
okay,
he kept talking about this thesis that he had that, you know, when Pittsburgh had to suffer through a deindustrialization transformation, that, you know, it was tough and they needed heroes and they were able to find their heroes in a rather unlikely place. And that was the Pittsburgh Steelers, who from 1933 to 1972 were pretty bad. They were horrible. All of a sudden, they were fantastic. They were great. And they're a team that was built in the community's image, you know, blue collar, gritty, hard nosed, bring your lunch pail to work type of folks. And, you know, the city of Pittsburgh, they went through this deindustrialization transformation, came out the other side smelling like a rose. I mean, Pittsburgh today is recognized around the world as this, you know, as one of the most livable cities in the world. They're, you know, renowned for academia, technology, robotics, healthcare, medical research, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they are a kind of like a model new economy city, whereas Pittsburgh's, you know, Rust Belt cousins like Cleveland and Detroit, Buffalo, you know, they've kind of struggled. They still struggle with this deindustrialization transformation. And so Tom had this idea floating around for decades. I mean, his family was tired of hearing about it. His friends like me, I mean, I didn't know him that long, but I knew him for about 15 years, but he just kept talking. This would be a great book. This would be a great book. Well, that cancer diagnosis of mine, that if not now, when motto, I looked at him one day and I said, hey, Tom, if not now, when? Let's start writing. I mean, there's a great idea, but until we start hitting the keyboard, it's not going to be anything but an idea. So let's take action on it. If we ever veer off of your vision, pull me back, man, and we'll get back on your vision. Year and a half later, we never had to pull back. We were able to go to market with it, and it's been well received and super happy about that. So, taking this idea of if not now, when, you know, what are the things that, you know, knowing that tomorrow's not promised, you know, what are the things that are most important to you? What do you want your legacy to be? Who are the people that you want to connect with? You know, our lives are filled with the minutiae. You know, but what's the most important thing for us? What do we want to do? What's going to give us joy, inner peace, satisfaction? What's going to put food on my table? You know, how am I going to nurture the relationships I have? You know, those are the things that I want to do today. And that's led me to my current motto, which is also on the back of a band t-shirt. And that is punch today in the face. You know, today is a gift, man. So let's use it up. As they used to say with the horses back in the day, it's ride it hard and put it up wet, right? And use up the day for every second that you can. And then when you're laying in bed at night and you're kind of dozing off, you can look over toward tomorrow's way and give it a point and say, coming for you next, right? So
yes, you can.
There we go.
So one thing I'd like to ask about, you have an acoustic band, a two-piece acoustic band.
Yeah.
The Chronic Padres.
Chronic Padres.
Can you tell us about them and how they've helped you, or how this has helped you in your cancer journey?
Yeah, you know, the Chronic Padres, a lot of people like to ask me, you know, where'd you come up with that name? I said, I didn't. My singer, Scott Sorocek, came up with it. He's got three daughters. I've got a daughter and a son. So I guess we are definitely Padres. And once you're a father, you're always a father, right? You know, so we're chronic about it. You know, I've been a musician for a long, long time, JR. And, you know, it's the days of me wanting to start a set at 10 o'clock at night, you know, with carrying a whole bunch of equipment with you and setting up, you know, you get there at 8, you're helping out the drummer and all that. And you set up for a 10 o'clock gig, tearing it down at 1, 2, coming home at 3. Eh, I'm too old for that. So about 10 years ago, Scott and I were just talking about it and said, you know what, let's strip it down. That's two acoustic guitars. And, you know, a 20 to 30 minute setup, 20 to 30 minute teardown. We're not in the way of the restaurant, the bar, the winery or whatever. Let's get in, let's get out, let's do our thing. And we love writing music. We love recording music. Most of all, we like playing music. And playing music is therapeutic for me. And I think it's therapeutic for a lot of people, whether they play music or just listen to music, right? You know, there's, you know, our heart beating in our chest has got a little rhythm to it. And there's like a little rhythm to life, you know, and you can see kids like picking up music and making noise and things like that. And it's, you know, being able to play, particularly with an acoustic guitar when it's just us, we don't have a drummer and things like that. And so, you know, even playing with a musical style that's kind of, you know, got a beat and a staccato to it, you know, because, you know, I am the rhythm section as well, right? You know, and playing that, just it's soothing, it's meditative, and it's fun. It's fun sharing our music or doing covers of other people's music, but sharing it with other people. We call ourselves the Happy Hour House Band because we like to get home, you know, sometimes before it's even dark outside, right? And so we play a lot of wineries, we play a lot of breweries, and we just like to hang out and hang out with cool people, doing cool stuff, having a fun time.
All right, so I would like to ask you about your educational background real quick. You got an undergraduate degree from Eastern Kentucky University, an MBA from the University of Washington. How have these academic pursuits that you went on influenced your life along with the cancer? Because having that much education, you know, you're a well-rounded thinker, and you're probably like me, because we're almost from the same generation. We were taught to be formulated thinkers. We weren't these assembly line thinkers that are present today. Mm-hmm. So, like, How did all of this stuff, like your education background, like with being diagnosed with the cancer and everything, like how did that play a role in how you were decisive and how you were going to continue to live?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And, you know, I can expect that from you, JR, because you ask good questions, right? That's what you do. You know, I like to break my education into two different way things because there was a pivot there and I was ill-prepared for that pivot, right? So being at Eastern Kentucky University, I studied finance and general business. And as a young kid, I wanted to be in finance. I wanted to be in investment banking. That's, you know, I watched movies about it and stuff like that. I thought, man, that'd be pretty cool. And then when I got there, it wasn't so cool, right? You know, I was 22 and I was making a lot of money, but you know, the people I was working with weren't that great. You know, as people, right? You know, it's very chauvinistic, that group. It's, you know, very, you know, you knew who the boss was. The boss was in the corner with, you know, two ficus trees in their office, two executive assistants out front, maybe even a wet bar or something. Like, who knows? You know, it was, you know, hierarchical and chauvinistic. It was, and, you know, the people weren't all that great. And at that point in time, I, you know, a lot of my friends were getting involved with companies that were, you know, using like Japanese management principles, you know, with consensus decision making and self-directed work teams and the like. And I wanted to get into that, but I felt as though like I was a factory that was made for finance. I need to retool my factory. So that's why I went back to grad school to get my MBAs, because I needed to get the skill and the knowledge around something else. And I love speaking with young people. I like speaking with my kids about that. I love speaking with anybody going through this, is, you know, find out what you want to do. And I think too many of us decide like at 14 or whatever, this is what I want to do. I'm going to do this. Cause you know, maybe dad does it, maybe mom does it, maybe the person down the street does it or whatever. But you know, I cherish the opportunities to discover, right? And when we're young, particularly when we're children, I'm talking like elementary school children, when you approach things with this beginner's attitude, right? And you're just a sponge for learning, right? You know, as we get a little bit older, we think, oh, yeah, man, I know everything. You know, I'm not going to learn anything. You know, we tend to, actually, social media definitely contributes us to us only learning about things we already know. You click on story A, you're going to get a bunch of things about story A, right? You know, and it's going to be fed into you, you know? And so, you know, go out, break out from where we are, go to the uncommon, JR.
Yeah.
And search out and educate yourself and find the things that you're passionate about, right? And so, you know, I wanted to work away from the finance and the people that kind of, you know, that the culture of finance, and get into the culture of people working together to accomplish great things, the leverage, the synergy that came with people, and that idea of the science of organizational development. And that led me to the University of Washington, where, you know, one of the founding fathers of that behavioral science, organizational development, is named Cecil Bell, along with his partner, Wendell French. They created kind of like the Bible for organizational development back in the 70s. So I wanted to learn from the guy who kind of invented the science, and that led me on my way. And then, you know, like I've already said about, you know, being diagnosed with cancer and kind of adjusting my outlook on things, you know, what else could I do? And how can I continue to grow? You know, cancer affects me in certain ways, but it's also given me things. It hasn't taken much away. I am still a father. I'm still a bandmate. I am still a husband, a son, a uncle, et cetera. But now I'm also a cancer patient advocate. You know, I'm an advocate for cancer patient caregivers, you know, the unsung heroes. I'm a fundraiser for both those things. So, you know, when you look at it that way, cancer hasn't taken away any of my roles, any of my accountabilities, any of my goals and objectives I'm trying to achieve. It's actually added to it. It's given me more roles and it's given me more purpose, more accountabilities, more objectives.
Okay. And I like that. And you mentioned something, family. If I'm correct, there's a wife, Lori, there is a daughter, Olivia, and a son, Raymond, correct?
That's right.
Now, let me
ask
you.
Quinn.
My
dog, Quinn, but he's a member of family.
Okay. So the member of family. So how has everyone dealt with this cancer, and how are you, and this is a wild question I'm about to ask, how are you supportive of them while you're going through this? Because that's one aspect that doesn't get asked, or I've never actually got that answer because you know, when someone has cancer, even if it's in remission or however, nobody ever asks how they're supporting the people that are supporting them.
Yeah, and I know I learned quickly that just by looking, I had to go through a stem cell transplant. Wasn't a whole heck of a lot of fun. Just even getting to diagnosis was a bone marrow biopsy. And I have a pro tip for everybody listening out there: not to be considered recreationally. It's not a hobby. It's not very fun to go through. My wife had to leave the exam room during my bone marrow biopsy because it hurt. And she didn't want to see me in pain. And I go back to the memories of Lori giving birth to our children, and she was hurt and she was experiencing discomfort, and I didn't like it at all. I mean, here's somebody I care for, I love, and she's not feeling so great, right? But I don't know where she can go on. I don't know where she is on her scale, right? And so she's got it under control. She knows, but I don't. And the anguish that I felt, and seeing her leave. She didn't know what I could take, either through my bone marrow biopsy, plural, because I've had more than one, or through, my stem cell transplant and the chemotherapy that went along with it and all that. And so I know, I can empathize with, her uncertainty. The caregivers, I in my support groups, I am around patients and caregivers. Some people have been both, and everybody who has been both says, without a doubt, it's the caregiver that's the harder role. It's and so if anybody who, first of all, if you know anybody that's going through a serious illness alone, reach out to them, because it is a heavy burden. I mean, there's just so medical appointments, medicines, but we get mail every day, a lot of it, real mail, snail mail, that is from a pharmaceutical company, an insurance company, a care provider, what have you. So if you know somebody alone, reach out to them. And then if people do have people taking care of them, what about the person taking care of them? It's like that. It's like, you just came back from Orlando, right? On your airplane, there's an unlikely event that the oxygen masks come down. If you're traveling with small children or people who need help, put yours on first and help them. The caregiver needs to be taken care of, right? And you asked the question about our communications about that. It's funny. Like my son's 26. Yes, my son's 26. He doesn't even talk about it. He doesn't want to know. And I don't think he just doesn't want his dad to be sick. And so he doesn't ask about it. My daughter, 28, she'll ask more often. Lori and I are I nice, still haven't had, like really deep conversations about what are you afraid of and stuff. So I'm doing well. I'm looking good. I'm feeling good. I'm doing well with this, but we haven't had really, some of the conversations that, will come at some point in time or what have you. There's still a little bit of, ostrich burying its head in the sand a little bit, maybe a little bit of denial. And let's go through today, and let's not talk about next week, next month, next year, and so on. It's a good question, and it is tough. The first phone call I made was to my daughter. I thought I'd start on the East Coast. She was at grad school in Nashville, and or law school, and so I thought I'll start with her. And it was the most difficult conversation I've ever had in my life. There's no manual. I wish I had practiced it in my head, but I thought, oh, I think I'm just going to call her. But my daughter at the time, she says 5 years ago, she's 23. I don't even know if she knew her phone. You could talk on one of these things. It was a texting device, an Instagram surfing device, or whatever. When dad's calling, I mean, she was almost in tears. I was calling, what's wrong? And I'm like, so it was difficult. And they are difficult conversations, but conversations you have to have.
Okay. And thank you for doing that. That was one of the gems inside this episode. Now, we're to a portion in the show where I like to pay homage to 2020. 2020 was a news magazine, and it still is a news magazine. I need to stop saying was, but it is a news magazine that had John Stossel on there. He was the comic relief. Diane Sawyer was on there with poignant interviewing skills. To me, she should have been where Barbara Walters was, but the late, great Barbara Walters will pay her respect. She made people personable, and like I always say on here, if she was doing a really good interview, the newscast would let her go to 11:05. Never. If it was subpar, they would cut her off at 11, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. And it happens sometimes. So now, Ray, you're on the hot seat. Are you ready for your 2020 questions?
Ooh, I'm ready. You can throw maybe a little Hugh Downs in there too, man. So take it easy. But okay.
All right. So first off, You do storytelling across three different mediums: writing, speaking, and music. Do you have a favorite medium for storytelling? And how did you decide which stories to share through writing and which ones through music?
Yeah, I like, I think I like writing the best because, you know, I have longer. I'm a writer, Chairman. There's hardly a word I don't like to write or I don't want to say, right? But, you know, it gives me an opportunity to go in depth. You know, not just maybe on the surface, but pow, get deep down. And then, you know, if it's a little too long for you, you can take a break. If it's compelling, you can pick it back up and take a look at it. You know, with a song, you're kind of stuck into like, you know, three verses, three choruses, and, you know, an intro and an outro and you're out. Right.
Right.
You know, there are some songs longer, but there's a limit to, you know, how long your song really can be. I like long form writing. You know, and I'll consider even a blog post to be, you know, somewhat long form, you know, 800 words, but then, you know, there's 130,000 words in Immaculate, How the Steelers Saved Pittsburgh, and about 60,000 words in Me, Myself, and My Multiple Myeloma.
Okay. Now let's do a little role playing real quick. And this, involves TED Talks, because TED Talks seem like they're the pinnacle of what anyone wants to do. And I don't know if that's something that you want to do, but
oh, sure. Does everybody want to be on stage at a TED Talk? Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
So let's go to Pittsburgh, for instance, because we got a Carnegie Hall, I believe, out there in Pittsburgh. Is that correct? Yeah.
There's a ton of Carnegie stuff. Most of the Pittsburgh, humanities,
still interesting,
things like that. There's lots of Carnegie's filled in the place. The Carnegie Halls in New York City.
Right. Let's carry to New York then. So you're in that Carnegie Hall because of your tie-ins with Pittsburgh. And obviously that ties into steel and it ties into a TED Talk. So you're at this TED Talk and you have to give the intro to your TED Talk. What is it?
First of all, I want a music intro. If I can have a little music intro, that is AC/DC's Thunderstruck.
Okay, I got you. All right.
Thunder. First time I heard that, I thought, man, if I ever become a professional wrestler or whatever, that's going to be my entrance music. Coming into that, the introduction, you know, I'd want to talk about, and I'd want to talk about punching today in the face. I would want to get people up. Get them shadow boxing or something, maybe getting beaten them on some drums, some kinetic activity involved, and talking about, you know, the gift that we have of today and the perils of taking time and people and relationships for granted. I want to be sitting on my deathbed. I don't want to be sitting back there going, I really wish I had, you know, dealt with more of this minutia in my life or whatever. You know, I don't want to sit back there and go, I'm glad I took care of business, the things that were important to me. And we all have different things. The most important things for you are different than they are for me. And that's great. Just identify what they are, go out there, grab a hold of it with the zest. And I think, did I answer your question there?
Yes, you did.
All right.
So let's take a trip down 995 from there and let's go to Baltimore. A little bit outside of Baltimore. Let's go to Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah.
This TED Talk, though, I'm going to help you with this one. This TED Talk is about cancer caregiver advocacy, because that's part of what you do. Okay. What would you tell these people that have come to hear about you? Because, you know, from the one in Pittsburgh, because we're using our imagination, you become more than just a national success. You become world renowned after that TED Talk. One TED Talk does that. So, you're here, and this is something that's near and dear to your heart because you've gone through this and you're going through this. So what do you tell these caregivers that need to hear what you need to say, need those flowers, need to know that there's someone out there that thinks like them and that, you know, knows what they're going through because you're on the end of being the cancer patient?
Yeah.
And you,
they need to know that they're heroes, right? They need to understand that it might be like a first responder, a fireman or EMT or whatever. Maybe they didn't like, I'm a fireman, I'm an EMT or whatever. It's like, no, you're a hero. And let's not forget that. So, you know, putting those caregivers up from a from the voice of a patient, not some, you know, caregiver himself, but I am a patient and this is what caregiving means to me, you know, and whether you've had the person that you're caring for or what have you been able to articulate that or not, who knows, but let me tell you what my experience has been, how caregivers have helped me out and how I think you've helped out the people that you care for. And then I want to let them know that, you know, you need resources. You need to take care of yourself. A lot of caregivers get kind of beaten down because they don't have anybody taking care of them, you know? And so, you know, they get beaten down mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and that affects them physically as well, you know? And so, you know, giving them the gratitude and the platitudes and letting them know that they're heroes, giving them, you know, ideas of resources for the way that they can take care of themselves, things that I've learned as a patient, how I can take care of myself. You know, one of the things that I like to talk to people about is, you know, cancer affects me, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And as a musician, you know, I'm used to like a mixing board, you know, in the studio, a little of this, a little of that, you know, adjusting levels. Those things for me, I have found, you know, systemically, me as the whole person, they either can drag, some of those variables can drag others down, or they can lift them back up. You know, and I'll give you, you know, maybe an example a lot of people can relate to, you know, New Year's resolutions, and I'm going to go to the gym, I'm going to work out more often, stuff like that. You know, and this is about the time of year, you know, we're recording this episode on January 30th, where people are like, you know, some of those New Year's resolutions are going to fall to the wayside, right?
And, yes.
It's not like they're injured, that they can't go to the gym. They just don't want to go to the gym. They're tired. They're like worn out. They got better things to do. Cancer doesn't take a day off. You know, heart doesn't take a day off. Diabetes doesn't take a day off. Kidney disease doesn't take a day off, right? And so, you know, you have to continually to fight, you know, but it wears on you. It gets tired. 2 weeks after my diagnosis, I was exhausted because I was approaching things as an event, you know, as an athlete, it was always a game, right? Or a race. And as a musician, it was always a gig. And on the job or in school, it was like a test, an exam, a deliverable or what have you. There's always this capstone, this milestone event. But you know, a chronic illness isn't an event. It's not a one day thing. You know, there's not a game day or a fight night. Every day is game day. Every night is fight night. It's a process, right? So I was approaching this as like, you know, I got to work out. I got to do all this, you know, and 2 weeks later, I was exhausted. I was mentally exhausted and emotionally exhausted. And those had dragged my physical, my physical, I guess, condition at that time down, right? And I needed to readjust myself. I needed to rethink things. So, you know, now, you know, like exercise is very important for me for a lot of reasons. One, you know, like it makes me feel good, makes me feel strong. And if I feel good and I feel strong, then I can go to the grocery store and I can, you know, go shopping for myself, come home and I can cook a nutritious meal. You know, on those levels, we're going to push up. My exercise is going to help lift my mental, my emotional, and my spiritual needs, right? And so, you know, I want those caregivers, John Hopkins, when I'm talking down there after my successful TED talk, I want them to, you know that, you know, take care of yourself. Just as you're taking care of the patient, take care of yourself. You're a hero to your patient. You're a hero to others. You're a role model to other caregivers who are faced in the same situation you are, but they're looking at you. And, you know, how can you adjust your mental and your emotional or spiritual, your physical components to get you, you know, firing all cylinders, peak performance, and doing what's most important to you, that's caring for your loved one, right? And, but by all means, heroes, man. And if you are ever down in the dumps and, you know, you need a little bit of a, you know, a hero introduced in your life, I encourage you and all your listeners, JR, go visit St. Jude in Memphis and, you know, just, you know, go check out their videos of these children, you know, going through what they do. They don't know anything else other than being a cancer patient. Their families are caring for those kids. And then all those care providers there, those families don't pay a dime ever. If you ever, you know, need to find a good charitable donation, you can do a lot worse than St. Jude. They're all of them are heroes, from the patients to the caregivers, to those families, that take care of those beautiful kids.
Okay. Thank you for that. Now, you've done great with the 2020 questions. And now, one thing that we like to do on this show is we like to pay homage to the people that have made us who we are today. So, Ray, please give a huge shout out or flowers to whomever has helped you become who you are today.
Hey, well, first of all, I want to give some flowers out to you, JR. Thank you for the opportunity. I very much appreciate it. I've enjoyed our conversation. My wife has been a rock beside me, not just for the 5 years I've had cancer, but for the 25 years before that. My children have taught me more than I have taught them. And then my parents, my mother passed away from Alzheimer's, you know, about eight years ago. But her and my father, you know, I was so fortunate to have come from a loving family. That I had both parents in my life as well. I know a lot of people don't have that. And, you know, they allowed me to be a kid for a really long time. I mean, I was a kid well into my 20s, you know, and that's one of the things, one of the passions I have is to, you know, let's try to have our children be children for a little bit longer than we let them sometimes, you know. In our world today, they grow up so fast, and it's great just to be running around in the creek, you know, looking for frogs or whatever, as opposed to, you know, some of the responsibilities that we put on them. And you know, particularly around the world and some impoverished countries, you know, the work that organizations like Save the Children do, you know, it's like, isn't it great just to see a smile on a kid's face and that. And, you know, my parents, you know, allowed me to put a smile on my face, allowed me to go through and wonder, to read and to learn. And yeah, so I owe my parents a lot, my father is remarried, and so I have another mom, lucky with that, and a new family that goes along with it. I have a brother for the first time ever.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty cool. And yeah, I want to thank them for, you know, continuing to you know, support me, love me unconditionally. You know, that's what love's about, right? You know, that unconditional love. I don't always do the right thing, but they love me no matter what. So
okay. And thank you for that. Now, one thing I do for the guests when they come on the show is I give them a quick little testimonial about themselves. So one thing that I noticed about you from the time that we started talking until now is this one thing. You provide a home to people. Providing a home to people is different than being in a house, because a lot of people in any generation grow up in houses and don't have the love, the condition, the compassion for passion and the passion for compassion that you have. And with you having those things, you're able to provide a home for advocacy for people that have cancer and for cancer patient caregivers. That's a lot to say. Yeah. And in doing so, with writing books, performing music, and giving art back into the world. That's a very hard thing to do, because nowadays this new generation has kind of lost that aura to them. Those type of form factors of writing, music, and speech. So with you providing that, you're still keeping that in the world, and you're enticing people to want to continue to do music. And that's something I want to tell you thank you for there, because that's lost art that's going away. Everybody's trying to synth this and that and all this electronic stuff to music to kind of deteriorate what we knew and what we grew up with. So thank you for keeping that legacy going there. The next thing is having fortitude, because you don't have to get on a stage. You don't have to share anything about your life. You could be bitter, you could be sad, you could be angry, you could be mad at the world for what happened to you in 2019. And even surviving until this time, you could still be mad, because you could say, why me? And just stop there. But you didn't do that. And with you not doing that, you saved somebody's life. You saved yours, you saved countless other lives that you may not even know about. So being on a podcast, writing a book, and enshrining your book in places, one thing I want the listeners to do real quick is definitely go buy this book, but I want you to do something else. I want you to go to your library and request this book, because the ISBN off the book once you buy it, and request it so it's immortalized in your city, in your town, because that's something that gets lost in translation with authors. Too many people buy the books, but they don't end up in libraries. We need books in libraries, because people still go there, and that's a formality that's getting lost in translation nowadays. So that's one thing I want you all to do there, listeners. That's a little bit of the library hack I always talk about. Now, going forward.
I want to thank you so much for your observations. I greatly appreciate, you know, being a, you know, you interpreting it as, you know, providing a home and the fortitude. You know, I was very fortunate when I was first diagnosed that, you know, I was interviewed for, you know, several videos, newspaper articles and the like. And you know, a lot of people, you know, asked me, is like, you know, what can I do for you? And I didn't know, but I do know what people can do for me now. And I do want to share them very quickly with you, very fast.
Okay, go ahead.
First thing, go see your doctor. My journey to being diagnosed with multiple myeloma was I was anemic on a routine blood test. And so it's like, well, let's find out. Let's confirm that anemia and then continue to search. Even though I was, my workout metrics, I'm a cyclist, my workout metrics on my bicycle were every bit as good as they had been for the previous 5 years. By the time I had my bone marrow biopsy, as the tests became further and further along, 90% of my bone marrow was cancerous. Look at that. Silent. I felt great. I looked good. I felt good. In hindsight, I may have been maybe a bit fatigued, but give me a break. At the time, I was 54 years old, had a full-time job. I was married and had two children in private universities. I think I earned the right to be fatigued, right? Yes. Go see your doctor. Number two, and I call these the twos, and you don't need a doctor, and you certainly don't need Ray Hartchin to tell you what the twos are. These are the too minis, too much, too littles. Like, yeah, smoke too much, you drink too much, you exercise too little, you eat too few fruits and vegetables, things like that. Beware of your twos, mitigate your risk factors. Number three, third thing anyone can do for me is if you know somebody going through a serious health issue alone, reach out to them. Help out. And I know what some of you might be thinking. It's like, well, what am I supposed to say? Start there. You know, just start and go, listen, JR, I don't know what to say, but I love you. I care for you. I want to be there for you. So I'm hoping we can kind of get through this difficult conversation right now. So then I know what to say, right? Number four is find your passion. And you're going to know your passion because you're going to get little goosebumps. I got little goosebumps right now just thinking about my passion. My passion is I wanted to share my story with me, myself, and my multiple myeloma. And I wanted it to be from the community, for the community. So, you know, it's ideally, I hope, I wrote it as a resource to be a resource, a behind the scenes look for patients and for caregivers and for allies. But net writers proceeds are being pledged to the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. I truly want this to be a resource from a person in the community, for the person in the community, giving back to the community. Everything I know about cancer, and it's not a lot, but everything I know is from the people who went there before me, through my support groups and my doctors and all that. And, you know, it's, you know, right now I'm in a position I can reach back and pull people forward with me. You're right. And I want to do that because I know there's times when I'm lagging behind and I need to extend my hand and someone needs to reach out and grab me and pull me forward. So yeah, four things you can do for me.
Okay. And I thank you all very much for that. So like always with any episode, I have Ray Hartchin with me and I am JR and we're signing off.